WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Right now, my guest is country comedian and star of the Grand Ole Opry, Minnie Pearl. In 1975, when she was awarded the Country Music Hall of Fame Award, she received a plaque which had this inscribed on it: "Humor is the least recorded, but certainly one of the most important aspects of live country music. No one exemplifies the endearing values of pure country comedy more than Minnie Pearl." Born Sarah Ophelia Colley in Centerville, Tennessee, educated at fashionable Ward Bellman College, joined the Grand Ole Opry in 1940. Her trademark, the dime store hat with the dangling price tag and shrill "Howdy, I'm just so proud to be here," made her first country music humorist to be known and loved worldwide. Minnie Pearl has written her autobiography, and it's called Minnie Pearl, An Autobiography. Welcome to Fresh Air, Minnie Pearl. Great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's very kind of you to let me come on.
Some people who have become known as comedians, and I'm thinking particularly of Anna Russell here, got their start trying to be very serious about, you know, singing, for instance, and found that people laughed at them, whether they meant to be funny or not, and that helped channel them into comedy. Did anything like that ever happen to you, where you were trying to really be serious but found that people were laughing?
Well, yes, I had that happen several times in my early life. I think probably what happened in my case was that I was unaware at the time I was growing up, I was unaware of the fact that God has given some people talent or the quality of being a clown, or rather being funny, being able to make people laugh. And it's a very rare quality, and one that people should handle very carefully and should be very proud of, which I was not aware of at that point. I thought at the point that I was growing up, and I would either consciously or unconsciously get a laugh, whether I intended to or not, I had the feeling that I didn't want them to laugh at me. You know, I wanted to be serious, and I wanted to be an actress. I knew I was destined for show business, but I didn't know in what capacity, because whereas most little children in my hometown who my age spoke of stage fright and spoke of being timid, not wanting to go on stage and not wanting to stand up in public and talk, I always had the feeling that I could do it, and it never bothered me. And it was only after I got into the business that I realized that stage fright is not, after all, just stage fright. It's apprehension, hoping that you'll do well, and the obligation you have toward people who are paying you and people who are in the business with you and people who are friends and family and so forth. But I was not aware of this gift. I didn't know what a gift it was. And I wanted to be a serious actress. And the book is about the transition from this little funny-looking skinny gal with freckles and a Dutch bob where the bangs were always coming down her eyes because Mama had five little girls and she couldn't get us all to the woman who cut our hair regularly. But the book is made up of this transition from this little girl who didn't realize she had this quality to the point in my life where I realized that comedy was my goal.
Your stage persona is a very loud, brash, raucous persona. Now, what was the image of femininity and girlhood like when you were growing up? Because I'm sure it wasn't being on stage screaming, "Howdy."
Oh, no, it was. This problem of women not wanting to be funny and wanting to be a sex appeal object has kept a lot of real cute women from going into comedy. I've run into them from time to time since I've been in this business. And they come to me after I've worked backstage, and they say, "I always wanted to do something like that, but I just never could bring myself to do it." Well, as you say, this strong image of a woman being a lady, particularly in the South where I came from, being demure and sitting quietly in a corner or sitting anywhere, not being noticed other than the fact that she was beautiful and well-behaved and had lovely manners, beautifully dressed and all that sort of thing. That was the image of a femininity that a woman didn't want to dispel by being funny. And it just wasn't good taste to make yourself an object of ridicule. And I grew up in that era, and Mama used to tell me to behave. Mama used to tell me to hush. Mama used to tell me to behave and be a lady. And Daddy said I talked too loud and walked too heavy and laughed too much and all that sort of thing. And they tried every way in the world and even sent me to a very beautiful girls' boarding school, which was a very fine finishing school at that point, Ward Belmont, which no longer exists. It was in Nashville, Tennessee.
There's a great photograph in your book of you when you were in Ward Belmont wearing this elaborately frilled dress.
Oh, yes. Ward Belmont in the 30s, when I went there, was comparable to, the finishing school, per se, at that point was such a restricted, almost a convent-type atmosphere. And we were supposed to learn at Ward Belmont, perfect our table manners, perfect our drawing room manners, and perfect our wardrobe, perfect our, particularly our speaking voices. And it's pretty funny now to think that that Minnie Pearl evolved out of that atmosphere. I wasn't supposed to be at Ward Belmont. We had lost our money in the Depression. My father was a lumberman, and they offered me, my family, my dad had sent four older girls to schools and given them an education. And when I came along 7 years after my next sister, they, when it got time for me to go to college, Daddy, as I said, had lost his money. And we really didn't have money to send me anywhere, but Mom and Daddy stretched and said they'd send me either 4 years to the state university or 2 years to Ward Belmont. Well, all my life I had heard about the dramatic department at Ward Belmont, and so I opted for the 2 years at Ward Belmont. Ward Belmont now has been bought by has been bought by the Baptist Church in Nashville, and they have enlarged it, and it's coeducational, and very little is left of the atmosphere and ambience and the picture of the old school as it was. It was built around an Ackland mansion, which was the home of a very, very wealthy family there, and had a beautiful series of receiving rooms in the mansion, which was what we call Rec Hall. It was Recreation Hall. Of course, we shortened it to Rec Hall. But when I hit there, I was not prepared for what I was getting into, and I still had this irrepressible sense of humor, which the Lord was trying to tell me I should use because it was so great. But I couldn't see it, and I cried the first whole month because I felt that I was out of place, and I felt that nobody thought I was funny or cute or anything else, which I try to bring out in the book is sometimes a stupid thing that people do unconsciously, of course, but people don't like people who are sad. You know, I mean, they're that is, who remain sad. I mean, you know, they're not drawn to them.
Well, the Minnie Pearl persona was obviously not what the finishing school you went to had in mind when they were trying to shape you. But from where in your life and from where in what you'd seen did you create Minnie Pearl?
Well, when I went back home, I had I wanted to go on to the American Academy after I finished Ward Belmont. There was a metamorphosis which took place at Ward Belmont, though. After I'd been so sad and homesick and had thought I was in the wrong place, I, through a series of events which I brought out in the book, I was able to get myself together and became a fun-type person to be with on the campus. And I loved campus life. I loved dormitory life. And I ended up being, immodestly speaking, rather popular on the campus. Then I went home and taught for 2 years. And then I went on the road with a producing company out of Atlanta, putting on amateur plays, still not admitting the fact that comedy was my way to go. And
what were you trying for at that time? Acting? Singing?
Producing. I was directing at that point. And acting, yes. I thought I'd still go on and be an actress. Because, see, I was only 21 when I left home to go with this producing company, and I thought by the time I was 30 I would be out of this producing company into Broadway. I just knew my name would be on Broadway in lights. And I had such indestructible dreams, I thought. You know, I mean, I had some setbacks by not being able to go on to a dramatic school, but I thought I was going to be able to really achieve this dream. And then I ran into this funny old woman while I was putting on a play in Northern Alabama with a Consolidated School there, and I had to stay in a mountain cabin. It sounds fabricated, because nowadays this would never happen. But at that point, there were these Consolidated Schools where they brought the children in the big yellow buses, and that's where we put on our plays. And it was something, as I said, it's hard for people nowadays to realize that this existed, this profession. The man I worked with had 150 coaches going out all over the Southeast. And it was a very unusual experience that I had up there. And I was so impressed by this woman, old woman, that was a country. She was a humorous country woman. And I came away imitating her and talking like her, just for fun. I always imitated people. And before I realized it, I had more or less created a character that people would laugh at. I'd just say, I was up in Northern Alabama putting on a play, and I met this old woman, and she said, and then I'd go into this act, not knowing it was an act, but, I mean, I'd start telling these stories. And the first thing you knew, I was collecting country stories, collecting country music, and I became, from having been from the country and then been in this other atmosphere, I found myself retreating and regressing back into the country atmosphere that I loved when I was at home. And then I named this character, and named her Minnie Pearl, because I thought they were two wonderful country names. And then I got the audition at WSM. It's a long process, really, and it's, as I said, it's brought out in the book, and I hope that it's brought out in such a way that it's fun. And the crises that developed were not all that lengthy, because I came out of them. And what I tried to bring out most of all in the book is that those things that seemed so hard at the time, if we just keep the faith, we'll come through them. And that's the way I feel about my life.
I bet you saw a lot of people, though, who had pretty tragic ends.
I did, and I have since I've been in this business. Show business is not, I don't think it's any different from a lot of the other professions. There's some survive and some who don't. It takes an awful lot of stamina. It takes an awful lot of, an awful lot of humor. It takes a great sense of humor to survive in this life.
I'm sorry.
I'm all right. What'd you say?
How do you think television has affected country performance, singing, and comedy?
Oh, well, it's just been our salvation. And all of us, it's given the record sellers more exposure, and it's given our comedy more exposure, and it's just been the lifeblood of our business. And I believe, though, Terry, that many pearls, I speak of her in the third person because she is different from me. I think her salvation has been the fact that so many, many people remember her from the radio days. See, I was on for 20 long, happy years every Saturday night on the Grand Ole Opry on the NBC portion of the Prince Albert Tobacco Company show. And if you have a program that you listen to regularly, like your listeners listen to this, it's the same time every afternoon, or it's the same time every week, and people sort of gear their lives to that, you know, and it becomes a sort of a part. It's sort of like a diary. It becomes a part of their day or a part of their week, and that's the way our show was. And now I've been on tour with this promotion now with Simon and Schuster for this book. This is the fourth day. We started Monday, and I have changed towns every day and have had numerous interviews and talk shows where the people called in, and it's been amazing how many people remember the Opry radio days.
Really?
And we're so into television, we forget, you know. But I was fortunate to have that exposure.
We just have a couple of minutes left. What do you think are some of the striking changes that have happened within the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, the country music scene has changed so drastically. We started out back at the Grand Ole Opry as a bunch of nice country people that were going around over the country, more or less like gypsies and troubadours, you know, putting on the play, putting on the shows in the small auditoriums. And then I think World War II had a lot to do with spreading this all over the world. And people became conscious of country music as an American way of expression. And folk music and country music sort of melded into, and then sort of a rock type has come in, what they call country rock has come in, and now country music has sort of spread around, and I wouldn't say dissipated, but flavored a lot of other different types, and then been flavored by a whole lot of different types. And people who work in country music now are not the same type people, a lot of them. They started out being all country background people. And now a lot of the people are not exactly from the country, and yet they love country music, and they love to play it, and they love to sing it. So we have gotten us to be a sort of a melting pot. We have a lot of different types of people. And there are people now who live in elegant homes, some of them, and they travel by jet, and they travel in limousines, something we never knew anything about back in the old days when I was beginning in country music. And used to, people would ask me for an autograph, and they'd say, it's for an old aunt of mine in Montgomery. They were almost ashamed to admit the fact that they love country music. This is really true. And now everybody that likes country music says, I love it. You know, and it is the surveys that the people like, well, our Country Music Association in Nashville has taken some very interesting surveys, and we're accepted everywhere, you know. You never know where somebody's going to come up. I have people come up to me, executives and society matrons and all sorts of different people, and they say, I love that country music. Of course, it's informal, and it's most of it you can pat your foot to, or it tells a story of some story back in somebody's life they can relate to.
I wonder if you think that there's any connection between what's happening politically and what's happening in country music. Now, for instance, when President Carter was first running for the presidency, he surrounded himself at times with country musicians and would have them perform. It's always interesting to watch the musical choices that presidential hopefuls have. But I wonder if any of that affects you and the people who you know who perform.
Well, it does. And I must say that President Carter has done a great deal for country music because he had the country music artists into the White House, and he had programs in Washington where he went as part of the country music audience. And we appreciate that, and it's going to be very interesting to see how President Reagan reacts to this. I'm not at all sure that he cares for country music, but then I don't know. I haven't anything to go by yet. He hasn't come in, and I don't know what he's going to do. But if a president, now I'm going to make a wide statement, and I may be called down for this. Your listeners may say that I'm mistaken on this. But in my estimation, if a president was smart, he would recognize country music. That doesn't mean he has to be chummy and pal around with all of them or have them into the more private recesses of the White House. But I think he should, if he is smart, a president, not just Reagan, any president, should recognize the importance of the country music vote.
Right. Well, if Reagan didn't like country music, what would it mean to the country music community?
Well, it would be a blow, but we would survive, having survived all these years.
It's really been fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's wonderful to be with you and to say to my Philadelphia and surrounding areas, howdy. I'm just so proud to be here.
My guest has been Minnie Pearl, and her new book is called Minnie Pearl, An Autobiography, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster.